Hello, everybody. Welcome to Book Talk from the Scottish Book Trust. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode, and we're going to be looking at three fantastic books today, all centered around family and place. We've got Emer McBride on the podcast talking about her novel, A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing. It won the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction, formerly known as the Orange Prize. So we have a great conversation with her about that novel. We also have Donald McLaughlin. He's got a collection of short stories that take us to Northern Ireland and Scotland and deal with characters who are in between both of those worlds. And we're going to begin the podcast today with Ron Butlin. People in Edinburgh might know Ron Butlin as our former mocker, our poet laureate. That job is now gone to Christine DeLuca, who's a fantastic poet as well. But Ron is also a brilliant novelist. And this book, Ghost Moon, has been winning rave reviews up and down the country. It's set here in Scotland, takes place in Edinburgh and Stornoway in the Outer Hebrides. It involves a mother and a son trying to understand his mother as she, I guess, comes to towards the end of her life. I'll let Mr. Ron Butlin explain. Here he is, Ron Butlin.
Ron Butlin, and the book is a novel, Ghost Moon. The book is the story of Maggie. It's set in the 1950s, and she is thrown out by her home, by her parents, because she's pregnant. And then the book tells the struggle that she has to win through against a society that was totally unforgiving and condemnatory. Its world has changed so much in these last 50 years, thank goodness. And at the end, she does, in fact, win through, but it's a great struggle. The book is also quite funny, but it's also, well, very serious as well. But it's a testament to Maggie's courage, her resilience, and her determination to give birth in her own terms, and also to survive. The book is actually the story of my mother. Yep, that child was me. There are two strands. There's the strand in the very early 50s, and then there's a present day strand, which is Maggie, and she's 90, and she's visited in the care home by her son, who's not me, I hasten to add. She's, you know, in a sort of at the beginning, we see that dementia is starting, and gradually, this life that she'd kept totally secret because she was so ashamed, because society had taught her well to be ashamed, she had kept secret and hadn't told her son, hadn't told anyone, and gradually, she is incapable of keeping things a secret anymore. And in the way that happens with dementia, she sort of utters things, says things that the son, of course, doesn't understand. But gradually, the reader is able to build up the whole picture of what goes on.
Is that aspect of it true? The lucidity of the dementia? Where's the fictionalized part? Is it just her story is based on her story, but then the method of telling that story, yeah, is made up?
Yes, certainly the method of telling the story is made up. Much of her story is made up as well. It's fiction. There's maybe one or two landmarks in it several landmarks that actually happened.
Had you realized before you started setting out to write it how much things had changed in terms of, I guess, what society's mores and morals and kind of the way we would treat people if they were somehow different or other?
Well, having as a child lived through the 50s and then as a teenager through the glorious 60s and 70s, my goodness, yes, I saw the change as it happened. And it certainly is a very, very big difference to what it was. I mean, Maggie, I don't think her situation would happen in the way that it does, that it would now, and it certainly wouldn't have the total condemnation. We have to remember that this was a time when, for example, on Sundays in Edinburgh, it's set in Edinburgh, all the play parks were locked and the swings chained up, and all the shops were shut, all the pubs were shut, etc., etc., etc. And the church very much was in charge. Certainly in the religious sense, maybe not in the law giving for everyday morality, people adhered to that rather a bigoted morality.
Rigid, strict. Is there a sense of, do you have any empathy for people who were caught up in that kind of judgmental aspect? Having written this, can you understand it any better now?
I wouldn't say I've necessarily got sympathy for the people. I mean, I certainly have a strong understanding, I feel. I mean, this was a society that had just been through the war, remember? And during the war, there was great license. Great license. I don't know whether it was given, but it was certainly taken, particularly in sexuality and so on. But at the end of the war, things, in a way, kind of bounded back, perhaps much harder than they would have done for quite a while. I mean, the 50s were a period of real austerity and hardship, and moral and behaviour hardship as well. That gradually, as a kind of affluence came in, so too did a kind of, let's call it a moral affluence, an easing of things, a less hypocrisy as well, it must be said.
Parents, they're such a powerful thing. They're such a figure in our lives, and you know, totemic and unassailable icons in our existence. Mm. And then to start to really get involved in their fallibilities and their three-dimensionality, their humanness. Was that a difficult thing for you to do? Because I know it took you quite a long time. It took you about 3-4 years, right?
Yes, I think particularly in my real-life father's situation, whom I did not get on with. I mean, he was a very troubled man. I think writing the book gave me a much closer understanding of him and the situation that he was in. And similarly, my mother, the more I began to think about what she'd done, the more moved I was, and the more grateful I was, just to see the extent to which she single-mindedly steered her life so as to allow me to come into to be born and to be looked after. The book actually started not conscious. I didn't sit down and determine to write this story at all. It was just there was one day when I was having a particularly very difficult period in my life, and I remember just sitting there and thinking, you know, what the hell is all this? You know, I've tried to do the best I can, live according to what I think is lights of integrity, and, you know, to do the right thing and so on. How have I got into this mess? And, you know, I was feeling pretty bad. Just out of the blue came a sentence that was, you know, you walk up and down the boat and keep walking backwards and forwards. And I just thought, what the hell's all this? Who's this, you know? And gradually, I know that I recognise the voice. I know this is a voice of something. It might be the beginning of a poem, a story, a novel, whatever. And I just kept it in my mind as long as I could, my imagination. And then gradually a scene built up of a woman on a boat walking and walking and walking. It took me a wee while, but I realised this, in fact, was my mother when she was carrying me, having left her home and gone off to begin this struggle.
That's really amazing, because you write poems the same way, don't you?
Yes. I'm afraid I don't think very much. I believe thinking's a bit overrated. I think I do believe it can get in the road of creativity. It has a place, but we have to really start with the imagination, trust it, and follow it, go where it leads, and then eventually I think we'll always find it leads us somewhere. And then once we're there, we can start thinking, perhaps.
Ron Butlin, everybody. You can follow him on Twitter if you like, at Ron Butlin Mocker. You can also follow us, the Scottish Book Trust, on Twitter. You can find us at Scottish BK Trust. You can give us the big thumbs up like on Facebook. Just look for Scottish Book Trust on there. If you don't prefer the social medias, go have a look at our blog and our website. That's at scottishbooktrust.com. There's a wealth of resources on there. Poke your head in and say hi. Up next, we're going to talk about a collection of short stories. And I'm a real sucker for a collection of short stories that has a narrative thread going through it. I don't know if you're the same way, but it kind of sits between being a novel and being a collection of short stories. And Donald McLaughlin, the author of Beheading the Virgin Mary and other stories, has managed to do this in a really elegant way. There's a thread of stories within the collection that deals with somebody who has grown up in Northern Ireland and moved to Scotland. His name is Liam O'Donnell. Here he is to talk about the collection and where it came from. Is the author himself, Donald McLaughlin.
Donald McLaughlin. The title, of course, is explained by the title story, in which a couple of boys playing football have an unfortunate accident and a statue gets broken. So we're not talking about the satanic verses here, even if it sounds like quite a cruel and dramatic title. What we are talking about is a book of stories in which every second story is part of a loose sequence. I'm a short story writer. I don't see myself as a novelist. People have suggested to me before that I could maybe take these Liam stories, the loose sequence, and turn it into a novel. That's not what interests me, however. I'm more interested in writing whatever story comes along. I think of it in terms of a loose sequence. That means when one comes along, I can write it separately from the others. And of course, at some point, you then decide on the structure of the collection when you get to the stage where you're thinking book. Yeah, but it's very nice to have that freedom to tell any individual story in any way I wish, and not to feel forced to adhere to one way of telling the story each time.
Or even one definition of the character, I guess.
There's that too. I mean, obviously there's development. The stories cover, in the meantime, you know, something like three decades. I focus above all on the 1970s. I'm interested in the childhood and youth of the character and his big family in particular. But there are stories that come up closer to the present day, including the title story of this collection. And the idea of having every second story focus on the family, the characters in this way, is that in between I can have other stories. So ideally the reader shouldn't read this as a novel, and those other stories punctuate the sequence. But we're talking about a similar community. We're talking about other Irish characters in Scotland. So that widens things out also. You know, you move away from this one particular family, the O'Donnell family, and you have other members of the Irish community in Scotland travelling the world in whatever decade, whatever it is they do. Okay, so this is the opening of the story Enough to Make Your Heart, which is set in the football season of 1971 to 1972, and it's part of the loose sequence of Liam stories that I've mentioned. It felt like Christmas had come early. First Liam knew his dad was tugging his toe. "Surprise, son," he whispered. "Get up and get on you quick. We're going to the football." "What, Parkhead?" Liam could hear himself how excited he sounded. "No, they're away this week in Dundee. Come on, get up and get on you like a good young fella. We need to leave soon." Liam waited for the door to shut, then jumped out of bed. Sean and wee Cahill, he could see, were out for the count still. Room was that cold, he was hugging himself as he hopped round, looking out his clothes. Even pulling them on, he was shivering. He hoped to God his mum had the fire lit. Sure enough, she was kneeling in front of the fire, a big double page out of the paper up against it, when Liam got downstairs. "The British Army is smaller than it used to be," the huge big advert read, "but so is the world." There was a hint of a heat if you went close. "Morning, Mum." "Morning, son." So the actual advert in the newspaper had this line in it: "The British Army is smaller than it used to be, but so is the world."
A crazy quote. So is that, that's actually from an advert, yeah?
Yeah, that's from a newspaper that appeared at the time. What I do is I write these stories, and if I feel I need to do research at all, I do that once the story exists. So anything I discover fits into the story, as opposed to research determining the shape of the story. And I'd actually gone to newspapers from 1971, 1972, in search of actual facts about a particular football match. And as I flicked through, I discovered this. And given that one part of this story focuses on Bloody Sunday, it fits beautifully. And even removing it from that context, it's quite a line, as you yourself have focused on just now.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, tell me about this, because Liam's a really interesting character, and I'm reluctant to draw too many parallels between, say, the author and their creation. But you know, he's a kid who left Ireland at a young age and moved over to Scotland, which is something that you similarly have done. I happen to know you because of your translation work, translating German, and also working with a lot of Arabic writers. The world is a big place, right? And that's kind of embodied in sort of like your career, like the work that you do around the world. But these stories are very much Glasgow and Irish stories, and it's very interesting that you go back to that period of time for this type of creative project. What do you think draws you to that material still, even though the world is much smaller and you're part of so many other different aspects of the world? I mean, we happen to be sitting here in Berlin doing this interview, for instance.
Well, I think this period, childhood, youth in anyone's life is obviously crucial. And yes, there are basic similarities between Liam the character and myself the author. But a phrase that I always quote, it's actually the title of a Janice Galloway book that appeared 6 months before my previous collection. And the title of her book was, "This Is Not About Me." And that would fit perfectly for both my short story collections. Actually, I have a German model for this project, a man called Alfred Anders, who lived from 1914 to 1980, is someone I read a lot in my late teens, early 20s. And he created a character, Franz Keen, to write about his childhood and youth, which in his case was the Weimar Republic and the Third Reich. He had the model of Ernest Hemingway and Nick Adams. And I didn't allow myself to read the Nick Adams stories until at least 20 of my own Liam stories existed, just because of the common language, yeah? But I was very taken by what Anders did in terms of creating a character just to tell stories about a historical period. And at some point I realized I could create a character, Liam, in order to write about the troubles in Northern Ireland, sectarianism in the west of Scotland. And I realized that if you experience the troubles only every 2 or 3 years when you return for a summer vacation, you have a special take on them, a special perspective. And that partly motivated me, you know, when I had still to write the first of these stories. That's something that occurred to me at one point. I thought, yeah, that's something to go for. And if I use the different voices, the different forms of English that have featured in my life, the dialect back in Derry in Northern Ireland, or language from the west of Scotland, if I can bring that into this project as well, that makes it different again from Anders or possibly even Hemingway.
It's so interesting because, yeah, it's about those historical contexts and making sense of, say, the 70s were an incredibly fraught time for politics in Northern Ireland and I guess the link between the Irish and Glasgow and that kind of thing. But there's also that disconnect. You know, so much of your roots are from this other place, but you're very much living there. And there's the entire community kind of is both loyal to that feeling of like, oh, we were from Ireland, but there's something missing, right?
And for me, it is about, it's about the big family. It's certainly not just about Liam. Something I was very careful of and wary of in the early days of writing these stories was I didn't want Liam to be a John Boy Walton, if you know that television series. And I, as author, certainly didn't want to be John Boy, you know, up in the attic or the back bedroom writing these stories. So it was a very different project, perhaps, from that one. I mean, it's very important to me that the focus is not uniquely on Liam. I start with the big family, the craziness of the big family, the many voices in any living room or kitchen, and then you've got whatever's happening outside, especially in Derry. You know, I do remember holidays from the 70s where tanks were literally rolling past outside and shots were being fired, stones and bottles and so on were being thrown by kids. Yeah, and I think you can reflect that in an interesting way by telling a story. The alternative is obviously to write essays or journalism about the political situation, which is something that doesn't appeal to me.
Donald McLaughlin, everybody. Beheading the Virgin Mary and Other Stories is a great pleasure to sit down and talk with him. And one of those great interviews that I get to do sometimes in a hotel room in Berlin. It was a real pleasure to be invited into that room and just to get a chance to speak to Donald a few thousand miles away from home. Lastly on the podcast, we're thrilled to have Emer McBride in conversation with Sacha DeBoule. Now, Emer's debut novel, A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, has been winning rave reviews from just about everybody who's read it. The Guardian has called it an instant classic. It took her ages to find a publisher for it because it's so unique and special and kind of weird at times. She's a fascinating author, and it's a real privilege to be able to feature her on this podcast. Here she is, Emer McBride.
Like Girl is a Half Moon Thing is set in Ireland in the 80s and early 90s, and it's the story really of a girl and her relationship with her brother, who's been left with some learning difficulties after a childhood brain tumour. And later on there transpires an unusual relationship with her uncle as well.
Actually, talking about the fact that it is set in Ireland, one of the things I liked most about the book was how Irish syntax, even though the style is very experimental, really sort of is suffused into the language of the book. Is that something you did intentionally? Or?
It wasn't really something that I set out to do, but it became increasingly interesting to me as the writing of the book progressed, and it seemed to serve the purpose of keeping a thread, actually, for the reader, which would maybe help them through the slightly more difficult elements of the style.
In terms of the Irishness of the book as well, it really is just like a punch in the face in terms of like that early 90s or late 80s, you know, what Ireland was like back then. And I think it's really interesting to see in an increasingly secular sort of Ireland that just one generation back you've still got all of this religious input. It totally took me back to childhood. Do you think it's an experience that people can still like relate to?
I think certainly for people of my generation it's something they can still relate to very easily, but I do think the country has changed hugely now, and it's almost unrecognisable from the Ireland that I grew up in, which was very much circumscribed by Catholicism and all that sort of strange conservatism that went on. This story wouldn't happen in Ireland in the same way now if it was set in today's Ireland.
Obviously the style of the novel is really experimental in terms of the language. It's a real break. It's really great to see a novel that can be so experimental with the prose, you know, do so well and really take on new readers and big audiences. Did you set out to write an experimental novel?
I set out to write something different, certainly. I wanted to give the reader a different kind of reading experience, and it seemed to me that no one had ever really written about that sort of layering of human experience, that, you know, stream of consciousness doesn't really cover what's happening inside the body and doesn't really cover all of those half thoughts and reactions and the fact that all of those things happen at once to us. They don't happen, you know, in a nice ordered row. Yes, I did want to see if it was possible to do that. I trained at a method school, for want of a better word, and which was all very much about, you know, creating the entirety of a character, and so it wasn't just about, you know, learning your lines and standing in the right way. It was about understanding very deeply the nature of people. And so a lot of the writing is a representation of what might be happening inside that kind of actor's head when they're on stage, actually.
You've spoken a lot about the fact that Joyce is a big influence on your work. I wanted to ask, because we have a lot of readers that read very widely, but they maybe don't read as much experimental fiction. With his work, if they've never approached Joyce before, is there any work that you would recommend specifically for them to read first, or anyone that influenced you particularly?
Well, the one that influenced me particularly and the one that I would recommend to anyone who has yet to experience the wonder of James Joyce is Ulysses. And don't be scared, just jump in is my advice. I think you will never read anything else like it, and after it you probably will never need to read another book, because all of the world is in Ulysses. It's not just all of Dublin.
You sort of started this writing process and you've written something very, you know, out there for maybe a general reader, but the story itself is quite basic and linear, and it doesn't cover, you know, a lot of elements. I mean, you know, there's a girl and her brother and some things happen. Do you feel that story is the most important thing, or do you think that form is where it's at, really?
I actually think that character is the thing. That's what's most important to me. And I think form has to serve character and has to serve the story. I don't think there's any purpose in just having a style on a page. It's an empty experience. And I think, and I hope, that's why readers, despite the experimental nature of the style, do have an emotional reaction to it, because it's not really about showcasing what I can do with language. It's about language being made to express something greater about someone's life, I hope.
Your main character goes through a lot over the course of the novel. How did it feel inflicting quite so much on your girl, who is a half-formed thing? It must have been pretty tough going at times.
It was hard, and I do feel that she, you know, she really has to suffer in the novel. But my point about that was not that she would be a victim, because I'm very tired of reading books about women who are crushed by the men in their lives, etc. And while it's honest to say that women experience a lot of difficult things in life that men never have to endure, a lot of women also use these as a way of going forward in their lives. And I think the girl is constantly trying to take control of her life and the situation, and the circumstances of her life are outside of her control, and she's constantly trying to work with what she has. She's always going forward, she's always making choices, and even if the choices have, you know, disastrous consequences, she is constantly in control or attempting to assert control over her life. And I think, you know, that's why it's different to a sort of, you know, misery lit book about, you know, this girl who gets crushed, because it's about that battle constantly.
As it isn't the most uplifting thing, I mean, I think it does say a lot about sort of, you know, the experience that women do have. Do you think that there is maybe a more positive companion piece that could, you know, have like a more hopeful ending, maybe in a book in the future about, you know, women's experience? Or are you quite happy to have a book that just shows, you know, how hard things are?
I suppose I'm not interested in making any kind of political statement, and Girl isn't written with that in mind. You know, those are the things that came out in the book because those are themes that are interesting to me, and it was interesting to pursue them in that way. I would very much bridle against any kind of idea that I should write a hopeful book to make up for the fact that Girl is a Half-Form Thing is so much about despair. But to write a book about happiness or to write a book about joy is certainly something that I am interested in doing, because I think it is a very difficult thing to do and much harder. So that's kind of covering a little bit of what I'm working on at the moment.
You said in an interview before that you don't shy away from writing, you know, something that is difficult or might be difficult for a reader. I was wondering how you felt about winning like such a big prize, something like the Bailey's Prize, which will bring a lot of new readers, you know, to your work. Do you think that, you know, people will respond well to work like this and it might inspire them to read more in the future?
I think so. Certainly the reaction so far has been very positive, and, you know, what's great is, you know, having not really expected to ever see the book in print, to suddenly have access to so many readers is a really wonderful thing, you know, for any writer. And I hope the fact that having won a prize like this, it will maybe inspire people to take a risk on it. And I think that's the purpose of prizes, is and should be to encourage people to approach things that maybe they wouldn't otherwise.
You mentioned that obviously you thought that the book would never be published. I wanted to say if you could speak a little bit about the writing process of the book, because obviously it was written, you know, some time ago, and sat for some time waiting for a home and has now found that home to great acclaim. Do you think maybe the world wasn't ready for the book?
Well, I don't know if the world wasn't ready for it, but I think the publishing industry certainly wasn't ready for it. It's hard to say, but it seems to me that it came out at exactly the right time and found all the right people at the right moment, which is, you know, an extraordinary thing, and is really about luck rather than anything else. And, you know, it took me 9 years, and I had a lot of rejection letters that, you know, admired the book and said that they wouldn't publish it because they couldn't find a niche for it. They couldn't see somewhere obvious that it belonged. And so, you know, in a way, going back to the Baileys, more than inspiring writers, I hope the success of the book inspires publishers to take more of a chance on the writers that they have. And I think that would be a really wonderful outcome of all of this. And I would feel very proud indeed if that managed to shake up publishing industry a little bit, because, you know, there are readers out there who are interested in more difficult or more challenging work, and there are certainly writers who are creating it.
I guess the last thing that I had to talk about was just that I really enjoyed the fact that the book wasn't really rooted in time at all. Like, you mentioned that it was set in the late 80s, early 90s, but it's not mentioned throughout the book at all. And in fact, even the characters have no names. Were you trying to create like a universal experience, something that could exist at any point in time? Or did you consider it at all when writing the book?
No, that's exactly what I wanted to do. I felt in some ways that by stating very specifically that it was set in whatever year and grounding it in particular places was maybe a bit vulgar for what I wanted to achieve and was maybe a bit obvious. And I wanted to see if you could also give a time and place without having to mention a time and place. So there was a challenge there. And as far as the names go, you know, I started out with it, but I didn't know that it would stay that way the whole way through. I thought at some point it might become clear, but it did not. And it was actually, you know, then I had made a rod for my own back doing that, because it's really hard to write a book in which no one has a name and still make it clear who the different characters are.
Emer McBride, everybody, thanks to her and thanks to Sasha DeBoule for that fantastic interview. It's not yet a film, but it has been turned into a play, which premiered in Dublin. Fingers crossed it'll make it over to Scotland and around the world soon, so those of you who are listening to this who don't happen to be in Dublin will get a chance to see it. Thanks to everybody who's appeared on the podcast, Ron Butlin, Donald McLaughlin, and you. Thank you so much for listening. It's been a pleasure being in your ears. We'll be back in your headphones very, very soon. Until then, keep reading. Goodbye for now.